From Edge Radio 99.3 FM, this is an edit of The Dice Men Cometh, the podcast.
The Dice Men Cometh!
G'day, Australia. And if you've got the feeling that the country is currently stuck inside a giant game of demarca, and if you actually get that reference, you're in the right place. Welcome to The Dice Men Cometh episode
124.
On Thursday, the
7th of July.
Thank you. July?
Yeah.
Already, geez. And since the country is currently stuck inside a giant board game where two sides have equal victory points, it's only fair that we settle it according to board gaming rules. Mark, if you'll help me out. So if both sides have equal victory points, it usually falls to whoever's got the most money.
Yes, but in this case, it's all publicly funded.
So who's got the most resources then?
Yeah, what sort of resources?
Well, wood.
No, you can't chop that down.
Coal.
No, you leave it in the ground, Trent.
Tobacco?
No one uses that anymore.
What about ore? Mining?
No. No one's buying. We're digging it up and no one's buying.
All right. Well, look, in that case, we have to fall back on the turn order to decide the election. The Liberals called the election. And if play is proceeding clockwise round the... Okay, look, you know what? Let's just roll for it. Let's just get Bill Short and Malcolm Turnbull in a room rolling a dice and we'll just settle the whole thing.
I'm glad you sorted that out for us, Trent. Garth, what have we got coming up on the show tonight?
Well, that was both odd and even, I must say. So well done to that. And I thought we should go to term order, not turn order.
Nice.
Anyway, nice. We are going to talk about what we've been playing this week, which is possibly an award-winning game, but regardless, we are going to go back in time to ancient Egypt to talk about Imhotep. We will also regale you with iOS and online and electronic games and all of those things. We will then talk about a game of the con. Was it a good game of the con or a bad game of the con? We will let you know. And Trent will then talk at us about something for a little bit.
What?
All that and more.
Am I?
On the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3.
What am I going to talk about?
Enough for me, it's all I need. Surely they've not haven't had enough of us yet. We've only been on air for 6 minutes. But anyway, that was the Hilltop Hoods with Pyramid Building. You are with the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3. Now, even though this may be a segue-free zone, you still managed to slip one in there with the music.
I didn't have to say anything, did I?
So, Mark...
Well, there better be a good reason for playing the Hilltop Hoods because I cannot friggin' stand.
Oh, I love the Hilltoppers. But before... I talk me about some pyramid building. Let me give a shout out to two of our youngest, yet I'd say most loyal fans, Rosa and Aiden. If you're listening out there, put your seatbelts back on, you little tykes. Get back down in the back seat. Because your dad, Adam, he's driving you. He's a pretty cool guy. We love him.
And we get paid millions of dollars to answer the question that Rosa said.
It was so funny because Rosa said to her dad, how much they make to get paid to make that show? And he laughed and said, nothing. And she said, why would you then?
I just feel like you've aged us all with everything you've just said, but go on, please.
Well, Rosa and Aiden are only like 8 and 13, so we are aged compared to them.
Okay. Anyway.
Anyway. Let us talk about a game. What we have been playing, Imhotep. Now, of course, you may think of Imhotep as a mummy shambling towards you as you turn and run out of a pyramid.
Or you might not, because Rosa and Aiden possibly haven't seen that film starring Brendan Fraser.
Let's hope they have.
But they'll be able to see the remake of The Mummy, which is coming with Tom Cruise in it.
What? Really?
That's right, because Universal Studios is trying to launch its own shared universe, a la the MCU, which every studio is trying to do.
Oh, and what Tom Cruise is going to be, right, is the one shared thing?
It'll be The Mummy, The Wolfman, Dracula, all of the Universal Studios monsters all tied together, and it starts with, I believe, this new film version of The Mummy.
Yeah, because Imhotep was the mummy from the original 1932 Boris Karloff film.
And what better monster than Tom Cruise?
But the whole point of me making that whole unnecessary point was Imhotep wasn't just a mummy. In fact, you know, they've never found his tomb, in fact. There's a mystery for you. Imhotep is two other things that I'm interested in tonight. Imhotep is a game published this year, 2016, by Phil Walker-Harding, friend of the show and...
Australian!
One of the most famous Australian designers, or most successful, let's say. And we'll talk about him and this game in a little bit more detail coming up. Art by Miguel Coimbra and Michaela Keenley, and published by Cosmos. And why are we talking about this game? Well, firstly, because we've played it. But secondly, it is one of the nominees for the 2016 Spiel des Jahres, the other two being Kahuna and Codenames.
Kahuna, Karuba.
Oh, Karuba. Kahuna, Karuba.
Oh, let's call the old
It's all a made-up name.
Yes.
In German
By
games.
By all means, let's pretend that doesn't matter.
That's right. And look, Phil Walker-Harding, as we said, he's got a great pedigree. Cacao! Sushi Go and the recently released Sushi Party. Archaeology, the card game. He's had success after success and hopefully more success to come. But Imhotep, you say. Who is Imhotep?
Well, I think we've established that.
Imhotep Well, maybe he will be in the future, but in the past he wasn't. He was an Egyptian polymath, or also known as, except it was way before the Renaissance, a Renaissance man. He did it all. Imhotep did it all. He served under the third dynasty king, Djoser, as chancellor to the pharaoh, high priest of the sun god Ra, and he's considered by some to be the earliest known architect, engineer, and physician in history. And before you ask that question, Trent, I can see it's on your lips. The full list of his titles was Chancellor of the King of Egypt, Doctor, first in line after the King of Upper Egypt, Administrator of the Great Palace, Hereditary Nobleman, High Priest of Heliopolis, Builder, Chief Carpenter, Chief Sculptor, and Maker of Vases in Chief.
So you know Mavis, who is a receptionist and who has the keys to the filing cabinet at your work?
Yes.
Without whom the whole place would just fall apart?
Yes.
That's Imhotep. To ancient Egypt.
You're right.
Just ran stuff.
Well, look, funny you should say about Mavis, because Imhotep was one of only a few commoners ever to be accorded divine status after death. Just as some of us would say, God bless Mavis.
And so he designed this game?
Well, no. But he was, as I said, he was an architect. And he was one of the first architect to build pyramids. Now, this game was actually called, I've got it written down here somewhere, called The Builders of Egypt in prototype. And it was actually Cosmos who gave it the name Imhotep because he was such a famous builder. He built the ancient step pyramid at Saqqara.
Ah, yes.
In the period 2630 to 2611
that's
BC.
That's very early in your Egyptian history.
Exactly. That is the first Egyptian pyramid. And as an aside, I rode a camel from Giza to Saqqara. 3 hours it took.
That's not a metaphor for anything, is it?
No, not at all. It was actually, an actual camel.
Yes, right.
Wore a hole in my jeans.
The camel did.
It did, yes. But back to Imhotep, he may have also been responsible for the first known use of stone columns to ever support a building.
Now,
he is cutting edge, and we're going to talk about a game in a minute, Trent. But according to some famous medicinal people, he was actually also the father of modern medicine.
So, by my estimation, you've been talking for 57 minutes so far, and you've yet to get into the detail of the game.
So, by all means... Sure, and let me tell you about in this game. We're talking about Imhotep, the architect and the builder, because we are shipping stone blocks and using them to build various edifici, in ancient Egypt, scoring victory points in the process. Now, this game lasts for 6 rounds. What we're doing each round is we draw 4 ship cards and we put out these 4 ships. Now, ships can have 2, 3, or 4 spots. And what you're doing with these ships is you're putting your big stone blocks, shipping them to various parts of the Nile to build things.
Now, I want to say this is the first part of the game that I thought was amazeballs, as the kids say, because these aren't some pathetic little wooden cubes, Trent.
Yeah. Mm.
These are mammoth, enormous wooden cubes that are at least four times the size of a regulation wooden cube. And that in itself is fantastic.
And not only that, you're not building pyramids and obelisks with green and red and blue cubes. You build them with white and brown and grey and black, like they actually look like stone.
Okay.
And that is a beautiful part of this game. So on your turn, you can do four things. You can get new stones, because you've got a little sled and you keep your stones there. You can only have a maximum of five. You can get three new stones as one action. You can move one of your stones onto one of the available ships. You can put it on any of the spots on the ships. The ships will have two, three, or four spots. You can sail a ship to one of the empty building sites. Now, you can sail a ship once it's got a minimum number of blocks, as indicated on the card, which I think in most cases it's one less than being full. And the fourth thing you can do is you can play these blue cards that you get from the market, which is like a one-off special action.
Well, so, Mark, that all sounds very easy.
It is, and that's the beauty of this game. It has that simplicity, hence why it's nominated for the Spiel des Jahres. Look, it reminds me very much of Ticket to Ride Like That, where there's only three things, or in this game, four things that you need to remember. It's a five-minute learning experience. Now, let me explain very, very quickly. So you're shipping to these spots. There's five spots. One is the market. Shipping stones to the market just lets you take some cards. And there's a whole bunch of different cards. Some cards are end-of-game scoring. Some cards are special abilities. Another spot you can ship is, it's Egypt, of course, pyramids. You build a pyramid. And you actually build a pyramid. So firstly, you're building the ground floor of the pyramid with nine stones.
These are stepped pyramids.
You're building the next level of the pyramid with four stones.
Yeah.
And then the third level has one stone. And then you get different points based on where the stones are in the pyramid.
Okay.
So you're actually building a big freaking pyramid.
Yeah, and I really like that as well, because it is only one pyramid for the whole game. So the game goes over six rounds from memory. However, you're only ever building this one pyramid, and this is where the first real sign of the strategy involved in this, because it's the order of the blocks coming off the ship is where they're going to be placed. So if I'm the black player, for example, and my black cube is the third one on the ship, it's going to be the third one to come off, and the third square building the pyramid might be worth 3 points, whereas the first two are worth 2 points or whatever.
Oh, I see. You're sharing ships.
Yes. Correct.
But then once they're full, one player has to actually ship them.
Yeah, yeah.
Ah.
So let me just finish about the other spots. So as well as the market and the pyramid, you've got a temple where you're just basically building a row of stones. And then when you fill the row, you start again on a row above that. And you score points at the end of each round based on when you look down from the top, how many of the stones of your colour you can see. So obviously you might have three in the first row, but then someone else builds on the top and all of a sudden you're obscured. So that's quite clever. The second last place you can put things is the burial chamber. And in the burial chamber, you are putting cubes down three across. It's about eight deep, but you get points for groups of stones. So stones that are orthogonally next to another stone gives you bonus. The more stones you have orthogonally connected, the more points you get. And again, it's that strategy of, well, Garth's got two stones right next to each other, so he's got two stones on that ship. I'm going to ship another ship where Garth doesn't have a stone to that spot. It might not give me a lot of points, but it's going to screw Garth. And there is that factor of screwage in there that I love, because it's not complicated, but it's fun, and it brings the interaction. The last spot is the obelisks. This is literally just stacking cubes on top of themselves, and the tallest obelisk will get the most points. There's also, now these
what
are...
the tallest, but surely your cubes are going to fall over at a certain point.
No, they are such large cubes.
Ah. Yeah.
And I think we might have had an obelisk that was maybe seven or eight stones tall. Another beautiful thing about this game, and I do want to use that word beautiful, is these five places have double-sided board technology.
Woo-hoo!
So it's an A side and a B side. If you flip over the B side, instead of building one big pyramid, you build four small pyramids. The burial chamber works a bit differently. So does the temple. There's just the variety in there, and you can mix the A's and B's, so it gives you replayability. So for me, I really think this is a beautiful game. Firstly, it looks beautiful. The big chunky cubes that you're stacking on top of each other where you're actually building stuff. I loved it. And it's beautiful in its simplicity because it's 5 minutes to teach, but there's a depth of both tactical and strategic gameplay that the very most inexperienced gamers can pick up. It's interesting and fun. Damn it. Right. It's interesting because it's fun right from the get-go. And as I said, there is a level of strategy there, but you don't have to think too much about it. You've got decisions where you can that can be made in a short amount of time, but there's interaction between the players that's fun. It's not a multiplayer solo game. I just really, really enjoyed this game, Garth.
I agree. I think one of the really big benefits for this game is that you can quite clearly make the distinction every single turn, do I want to do what's best for me, or do I want to just spend my turn screwing over the other players? And the clearest way to do that is to guide one of those boats that you may or may not have cubes onto into an area that is just going to be bad for those other players. And I think that's a really enjoyable aspect to this game. The fact that we were taught it in no time flat was outstanding. And I just think, again, you can see why it's a Spiel nominee because of that fact. It's got a lot of pluses.
So Spiel nominees, as we now understand, are basically mass market games in hiding that could cross over into your Kmart stores and your Target stores in a place like Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Would this qualify? Is it simple enough?
It is simple enough. I can't see this being sold in Target in Australia. In Europe, absolutely.
Yeah, right.
And remember, this is a German competition. Look, a couple more quick things. Something that really amazed me, the prototype edition, as I said, Builders of Egypt. This won second place in a design competition in Italy called the Premio Archimedi Board Game Design Competition, run by Studio Giochi, which is an Italian game studio. It won that in 2010. And I remember we were taught this game by David Harding, Phil's brother, yeah, the guy from Grail Games, another great friend of the show. Thank you so much, David. But what he pointed out to us was this game was given pretty much finished as is now, apart from that they changed the name, to Cosmos in, I think, Garth, it was 2011 or 2012. So they've had it basically as a done deal for 3 or 4 or 5 years. Again, another fascinating point in this competition was Builders of Egypt won second place. Guess what came third? Cacao! In the same competition. So, Imhotep, I think it stands for, in my humble opinion, 'tis excellent, Phil.
So, sounds good. How long have you been talking for, Mark?
5 minutes, according to this clock that I forgot to press at the start of the break.
So anyway, what we'll do is we'll play a song, we will come back and regale you with more news here on The Dice Men Cometh.
And he only said interesting twice. Dice Men Cometh, Edge Radio 99.3 FM and the Kings of Leon. Whatever it was called. We're talking board games and card games on this show with Trent, Mark and Garth. We're talking what we've been playing lately. We've discussed Imhotep, but there's more what we've been playing lately. Well, what you guys have been playing lately anyway, because I didn't come along to BorderCon, wasn't able to. Well, I wasn't able to free up the time.
Whatever, I was having, make the time.
You chose not to go.
I was having my own family holiday, all right? Happy wife, happy life.
Nah.
Okay.
Nah. Disappointing.
More board games later.
Anyway.
Right.
Anyway.
No excuses.
One of the games that we were able to play at BorderCon, and it was actually, Mark, was it the only game we played twice for the whole weekend?
Oh, I played Imhotep twice.
Ah.
That's because you were busy before playing the new start games of it. And Burgle Brothers, we played twice because we lost it in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, damn Leon. So anyway, I'm going to briefly talk about Thunderbirds.
Oh, that'll be refreshing.
Now, I will be brief. I may even talk, 1.5 times speed just to get through it really quick, do you reckon? But anyway, Thunderbirds by Matt Laycock. Leacock? Laycock? Leacock. We'll say Laycock. L-E-A.
Lia.
Anyway, he's a little bit famous in our hobby because he's designed a swathe of pandemics, including Pandemic Legacy. He's made Deserts Forbidden with Forbidden Desert. He has done Nitwit, which is a bit of new hotness there, where the box contains some spools and knitting needles and bits and pieces, which is quite a bit of an exciting concept in our game. So he's a little bit famous and is the designer of the number one game of all time. So this guy has got a bit of gaming credential about him. Now, it's published by Modiphius Entertainment. It was last year. Like, it was a mammoth Kickstarter. It had basically 3,500 backers. It raised 218,000 poons, as you would say, Mark. So about $100 million, or maybe not after Brexit. But this game plays in theoretically 45 to 60 minutes and is for ages 10 and up. You could play it solo if you wanted to, Mark, but the best thing is to do is to have four of your BFFs around the table, because this is a co-op game very much in the vein of the pandemic-style games that he has created. However, it is set in the year 2065 with those Thunderbirds that we've all known and grown up with in the 60s,
well,
70s? I don't know. I'm too young for all of this stuff.
Mark, I'm approaching your age. And for, I think for any kid of the 70s, 6 o'clock Saturday morning was Thunderbirds time. Yep. Hugely influential.
Shall I bring the car around, my lady?
And doesn't necessarily bear a return visit in your adult years.
No, no.
But, gee, growing up with it was fun, wasn't it?
Well, you know, for the kids that don't know...
That's right.
Think about... Team America, that movie, that being G-rated, you've got the Thunderbirds.
And without the irony, sure.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
So look, let me give you a little bit of the backstory. Look, it's a secret organization committed to saving human life, secretly founded and funded by the millionaire Tracy family, with the motto, and this is clever, never give in at any cost. International Rescue has a host of technologically advanced land, sea, air and space rescue vehicles and equipment ready to launch at a moment's notice, racing to the rescue from a secret island base beneath the luxurious home of the Tracy family somewhere in the South Pacific Ocean. International Rescue defies government spies and criminals who want the secrets of their incredible machines for their own. To combat this threat, Lady Penelope, the Thunderbird's aristocratic English secret agent, and her chauffeur, Parker.
Yes, my lady.
Lead a network of, next page, agents to undercover behind. Anyway, so look, it's a, it's a secret family doing secret espionage and spy things trying to save the world with that motto of never giving up.
And it's ripe for a board game
is
adaptation.
Is it ever? Is it ever? Now, if you've played Pandemic, think of Pandemic's board. You're trying to get from various parts of the world to other parts of the world rather than moving cubes. You are using your various Thunderbirds.
Okay.
Now, I learnt doing the research for this that there seem to be five different Thunderbirds.
Yeah.
So, see, I'm not too young for this.
Yeah, there are
stuff.
Always five.
Well, I don't know that. There's Thunderbird 1.
Yes.
2.
One comes out of the pool. Two's the giant green aircraft carrier thing with the which carries Thunderbird 4, which is the submarine. Thunderbird 3 is the red rocket that goes into outer space. Thunderbird 4 is the submarine. And Thunderbird 5 is the
space station.
Space station.
All right,
and then you've got the big pink car.
Which isn't a Thunderbird.
No, it's not.
Doesn't qualify.
So, Trent,
but it's
I
still
think,
cool.
Based on your knowledge, you may really enjoy this game. I didn't. However, what I want to compare this game is to Pandemic. So it's an easy way to describe it because so many of our listeners would have played Pandemic in some way. Now, the differences are this has two threat tracks. Now, you've got the events and the schemes at the top of the board. Now, this is where it is very different to the Pandemic style because it's got that at the top. And then down the bottom, it's got the disaster track. Now, the disaster track is essentially the fires that you have to put out all over the world, and you have to do that
and in
using,
space
and in space unfortunately in space however you have to do that using a combination of Thunderbird vehicles, members of the Tracy family, possibly benefits that you have to bring, like the mole and a few of the other pieces
some
of
the
equipment
special
that
little
you need
vehicles
to get So essentially, you're going to those parts of the world. It might say you've got to complete this objective in the North Atlantic. And in order to get the most bonuses, you have to bring Thunderbird 1. You have to bring...
Scott and Virgil.
Yep, Scott and Virgil. And they have to have a...
The mole and the drilling machine.
Something with them. Now, in order to do that, you use your actions moving them. And then it's just a roll of the dice to try and beat the number on the threat card.
And is it a generic type disaster, or is it like a terrorist attack or a crash of an aircraft?
No, look, having watched a few episodes over the years, and certainly not at all a complete Thunderbird fan, as you may have gathered, it seems to be like the things you are trying to solve are thematically in line with what the Thunderbirds did during their show. So I think they've actually done a really good sort of job in that respect.
So that's the flavour text on the card, but ultimately it just becomes a roll of the dice.
Well, it is, but you're spending your turns, and because it is a co-op, other players are spending turns trying to put out this fire collectively so that you can boost your chances.
Yeah, and so it'll say, okay, you've got to stop an asteroid from crashing into the moon.
Okay.
And you need to roll 13. But if you have Lady Penelope and that'll add an extra 2 to the roll.
Yep.
If you have Thunderbird 5, that might add an extra 3 to the roll. If you have the space telescope that you build, that might add an extra 1. And so the more of the bits of the puzzle you can put there, the more chance you've got of defeating that thing.
Yeah, exactly right. Now, the second thing about this is those events and schemes at the top of the board. Now, basically, this is a bit of foresight into the game because there is going to be something really bad that happens. There are three schemes that happen during the course of the game, and you know what the next one is going to be. There are certain events and certain cards that you will draw that will say that will progress the hood track, as they say, because the hood are the arch enemy of the Tracy family and Thunderbirds, from what I gather.
These sound like the
epidemic cards. They are exactly like that. You get to see them coming up, though, so you need to be able to resolve the top track before the hood track gets to a certain point, because if that ever happens where the hood track outranks the threats, then it's insta-lose of the game. So not only are you spending your turn trying to put out these little fires from the disaster deck that just keeps coming out and out and out every turn, you've also got a bigger picture in mind in that you've got to resolve these three schemes over the course of the game to try and stay in this game. Now, look, you can look at a whole bunch of videos on this, and no doubt it has had a lot of press because it is Matt Laycock, it is Thunderbirds, and it was a massive Kickstarter success. I would rather talk about the experience that I had with it and that you had with it, Mark, because I want to say straight off the bat that I was really, really looking forward to playing this, and I was really disappointed once I did.
Mm.
I played it, and look, normally I'm a positive guy when it comes to these games, but the pieces were really, really fiddly. I love the little plastic minis, but the fact that you've got these tiny little, they must be a centimetre high Thunderbird people that you're meant to put in and put out of the various Thunderbirds, it's just fiddly and not much.
It's just
fun.
A lot of mucking around. You could have done it with cards or tokens, and to have to take these little, oh, Scott is going to get out of Thunderbird 1 and put in Thunderbird 2. And the fact that you could get in and out of vehicles as many times as you liked, it didn't matter.
Yeah.
But the vehicle had to have person X in it at spot Y.
Right.
It was just an unnecessary bit of fiddliness. And look, I'm sure this game, if they had wanted to spend more, they could have made some amazingly detailed vehicles and little busts or whatever.
Agreed.
Because they didn't, they went for like tacky plastic crap. It looks crappy.
Well, that again sounds like the mechanic in Pandemic where you're swapping city cards.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Look, it is exactly that.
So you could have done it with cards. Yeah,
oh, definitely. Now, again, not being a Thunderbird fan, and I think by almost a virtue of where I was sitting on the board, which was I was sitting at the top of the board, so everything I was looking at was upside down, I couldn't tell what I needed to do. So I couldn't read the cards on the bottom of the board because I didn't know who Virgil or John or Tracy were and what their respective Thunderbirds were and where they needed to be and what their bonuses would give to my dice roll. So I just found it really fiddly, and I didn't really find it an attractive-looking game either. I mean, I'd much rather sit down there and play almost any version of Pandemic out there. I'd certainly much rather play out another game of Pandemic Legacy, that's for sure. But I also found in one of the games where I played John Tracy in space.
Oh, yes.
Now, John Tracy in space in Thunderbird 5...
never got to do very much.
No.
And that's exactly how the game plays out. And I just find that to be a completely poor design decision, because for the game that I played, and I also had a chat with Leon about this, because he played it once or twice as well, is that we both figured this mechanic of moving up and down and putting out the occasional space fire could have been done as an NPC move, that it didn't need to be a player. And the thing that makes it infuriating for me is that at the start of the game, you just dealt a random character. So it's not even something that you're liaising with your fellow Thunderbird people about. It's just a blind luck of the card draw as to who's playing and what abilities they're going to bring to the game.
And well, the other thing, or one of the other things, is you have all the Thunderbird characters in play, the whole six of them, but only four of them are being played by characters. So two of them are non-player characters, but it's not like you ever don't have them there. You always have access to all of them around the world. So it's like it doesn't matter if it's a player or a non-player. That makes no difference. Another thing I found frustrating was there was that track along the bottom where the sort of the spot fires, if you like, that you had to deal with, the short-term issues, were laying out and moved along. And then when you dealt with certain spot fires and made, if you like, gaps in the track, the other ones ahead of it never moved back.
Yeah.
And there was a special way to move them back, but it was quite complicated and hard to do. It was almost like you could never get ahead of the game. Now, yes, that did keep the pace going and made it sort of fast-paced. I just felt like they took an amazing game, slapped a really interesting theme on it, and yet somehow turned out a mediocre game that actually almost demeaned the theme.
Ooh.
That was my experience, is the theme almost detracted from it, with the fiddly little people moving around, the tacky little plastic vehicles.
Well, Pandemic is fast becoming like the new Risk. Yeah?
Yeah.
Where Risk has been, the essential basic mechanics have been redeployed across a bunch of different properties, and with slight variations on the rules, some of which work, some of which seemingly don't. And it seems like the Pandemic rules haven't quite been applied. So it sounds more like a grand experiment that's just failed.
The thing is, though, you do the pitch for it, and it sounds like it should work really, really perfectly.
I was blown away, and I thought, I cannot wait to play this.
And I have to say, I'm unsure whether that clouds my judgment of it, because I walked into the game thinking, wow, this should be a really good fit. And I really should be able to get invested in the Thunderbirds and the Tracy family, even though I'm not a fan of this, because I know that their whole purpose is to go around and save the world. So we're doing that. It's more exciting, theoretically, than being a whole bunch of scientists and going and putting out a cure of a disease every now and again. But it just did not work for me.
Well, and it took international rescue, and it turned into international juggling of jigsaw pieces.
Yes. So anyway, look, let's move on.
Well,
let's
thank Richard Canning.
Oh, totally.
You know, a great friend of the show, has even purchased one of our Dice Men t-shirts, and he cuts a stunning figure in it. He taught us this game. Really appreciate that, Richard. Thank you so much. And look, apologies if we whinged about it at the time, and now we're whinging about it again. No reflection on you. This game is just a letdown.
Well, look, we've talked about whether or not we should do negative reviews on this show, and I don't think it hurts to do the odd review where we clearly don't like a game.
Yeah.
I mean, I think particularly in a case like this where something was so high profile and so hyped.
I agree.
But if you could tell me, Mark, how long have we been talking for?
15 minutes.
15 minutes, is that right? And how many times have we said the word interesting?
That was one.
Okay. All right. We're ahead of the game so far, perhaps, or not. The way you're looking at me. Oh, gee. Put the knife away, Mark.
That could be as elegant a summary of the game we just talked about a minute ago as any. That was World Full of Nothing by Depeche Mode. You're with the Dice Men Cometh, Edge Radio, 99.3 FM. Now, Garth,
yes,
you've been, I was going to say tied up, but I don't like to Think of that picture. You've been in the toilet again.
I have been.
Playing your electronic devices.
Because that's
you?
A much better picture than me being tied up, isn't it? Oh, dear. So, yes, I have been. Now, it's been a little while since an iOS update, and it will continue to be a little bit of an update because this is going to be more about a chat of a couple of iOS games that I've been playing, Trent, that you have even dared to dip your toe into.
Oh, my God, don't get me started.
As part of this Balinese holiday that you went on so you could spend more time with your phone. But before we get to that,
what?
I wanted to have a chat about Castles of Mad King Ludwig. Now, this was a game that was the follow-up to the success of Suburbia by Ted Alsbach and Bezier Games. Now, I'm not going to talk about the real games because we've already done that forever and a day. But Castles of Mad King Ludwig came out a few months ago on iOS and electronic devices.
Suffice to say that in Suburbia, you're building a little town. In Castles of Mad King Ludwig, you're building a crazy castle. But the two games deploy a fairly similar mechanics.
And they do. And
you might say that Castles was a little bit of a refinement of it. Depends on which side of the fence you're on.
Yeah, exactly. Now, personally, I really, really loved Suburbia.
Oh, yeah.
I loved the whole go-to-woe experience from opening up that box and placing down that first hexagon to the scoring mechanic and what have you. So the very first time I played the physical game of Castles of Mad King Ludwig was at BorderCon a year ago. And that was a fantastic experience to be able to play that and compare the two. And I've done a bit of the same with the iOS versions because I've gone back and I've had a bit of a play with both of them because, again, there are a lot of similarities, but there are enough differences to make it worthwhile to have both on your electronic device, my humble opinion.
Are the apps by the same company?
Yeah, they're all done by the same technological people who write the code.
right. And are you playing these sort of solo against AI, or are you playing with other people's?
Playing with AI, and that's something about Castles of Mad King Ludwig. You can't play with real people on the other side of the world in their respective toilets. You can do the pass and play, where you play on the one electronic device, sitting around the table, not being able to see it all.
Yeah, I thought pass and play was playing on the toilet, but let's continue.
And that's exactly where Suburbia started. So, look, the joy of Castles of Mad King Ludwig surely is that you get to be that crazy architect of the Mad King's castle and make it look as ridiculous or as absolutely, anally, accurately perfect as you want it to be while still going for those delicious victory points. Now, this is where the first similarity with Suburbia and Castles comes into it because both of them have a really clear tutorial or introduction to the game, because one of the challenges with any form of electronic gaming is that they almost always do not teach you how to play the game very well. So it comes to being, I guess, a little bit exclusive in that you need to know the game already to justify the spending of, in this case, I think it's about $10 Australian to get the game, because it's not going to walk you through as clearly as I would like to be walked through if I didn't know this game. Now, the great thing that Castles does is that it does do a 10-step tutorial process where it introduces the different mechanics of the game. And the mechanics of the game are really how the rooms connect with each other and how the various scoring bonuses all work in. Now, I think it did that much better than Suburbia did initially. And I guess what it's also got going for it is it's a more interesting look. Because you've got pieces of various size and various colour and the fact that you are building a castle, rather than yellow, grey, blue hexagons that are all pretty dull. So I liked that straight away. Now, the next thing was I liked the fact that you had to pass each tutorial to be able to go on the next one. It wasn't just this is how you learn to place a tile and this is where it works. You got to have to then put what you've learned into practice. And look, we're talking about a tutorial that takes maybe a minute at most. So it's hardly going to spend a huge amount of time. It's only trying to introduce doors have to line up, downstairs have to line up with downstairs rooms. It's the basic stuff, but it's what you need to then be able to be competitive. Because the next thing I like about this game, and I've only played against AIs because, guys, you've not been sitting in my toilet lately.
Thank God.
Yeah.
That's what you think.
That's what that camera's for. But I like the fact that the AI, from my experience, is really different because you can choose a varying... It's like, you know, Carcassonne and all those other games.
Oh,
you can choose the different styles of AI that you've got, and they do play the game differently.
There is not enough of that.
There isn't. And games that say there is, it's not as blatant as it is in this game. So I really enjoy the fact that you can play against an AI that is the bumbling or the learner AI, and you can wallop it. Or you can play against the gamer, you know, AI that is all about the efficiency and maximizing points, and you will get creamed. And I think that is great because it allows you to adjust the opponent to your style of play and also how you're feeling at that given moment. Do I want a really tough, intense game, or do I want to feel good about myself and have a victory?
So let's leave aside Mad King Ludwig versus Suburbia as the better board game. Is this the better app?
I think what has happened with Suburbia is that it has improved over the years. Now, it's been out for, I don't know, maybe a year, maybe 18 months or what have you, and it's had a couple of updates that have really refined it and I guess particularly made the whole experience a bit more seamless. For this, as an initial rollout, I really like it. I'm impressed. I think what they've done is they've learned from the mistakes that happened in Suburbia, and they've refined it. Now, the first thing that I thought was a very clear difference was that in Suburbia, you can basically metagame this. You can drag the hexagon that you think is the one you want, you can hover it over the space that you want, and it'll show you how it affects your population and it affects the income that you get, but you don't have to place that tile.
Okay.
So you can go from the half a dozen or so that are available and go, well, that one, yeah, that works in that spot or that spot or that spot, and it gives me this population or this wealth or this or that. And you can do that with everyone. So there's absolutely nothing to say that you cannot win purely through trial and error. Whereas with this one, with castles, once you've placed that whatever size room that you want to put on, yeah, you'll get your bonuses if you're getting them, but there's no going back from there. And that is something like no virtual take-backsy card. It is fantastic.
Now, one of the critical decision points in the board game was that you weren't allowed to like take a room and sort of measure where it was going to fit. So can you do that in the game? Can you do the hovering thing or not?
No, so this is where one of the weaknesses is, and it's probably because of coding and what have you, is that when you select the tile that you want, it will then give you a bit of an outline of where it's going to go. Yeah. So it does remove that part of it, which I don't like, because I agree that one of the big challenges with that is, oh, I reckon it can work, but, you know, if I put my thumb and my finger and measure the size of it and put it next to that other thing, I just can't tell.
Or those doors that I thought were going to line up.
Yeah.
Damn it, they're one square out and they don't line up.
Exactly.
And I totally miss out on some points.
Yeah, now the flip side of that, though, is that with castles, you've got, and I'm just going to use circle rooms as an example, you've got circles of various sizes.
Yeah.
But when you're looking at the top track of the available tiles and how much they cost, all those circles are the same size. You've got to have a bit of knowledge about, you know, this 150 circle is clearly smaller than the 250 or what have you. So, you've got to have a little bit of experience to figure out whether that size room is going to have any shot of fitting where
you perhaps that's why they've done it that way, because you can't get the pure one-to-one visual
ratio. Yeah, you don't get
ratio.
The visual. Exactly. Yeah. So, look, that's another part of it that... It's just a nature of the medium in that, you know, if the iPad was 27 inches wide, then of course you'd be able to do that, but it's just not how it is.
Now, what about the market mechanic? Because for me, that was one of the fascinating decision points of Castles of Mad King Ludwig, was you had to price each, when it's you're the master builder, you had to price each of the pieces, because sometimes you want someone to buy it, because that's how you get your money to spend, but sometimes you don't want someone to buy it because you want that piece, but then you're going to have to not get money for it. That, to me, I struggle to think, how can you do that in an AI environment? Because you're not having that negotiation of, oh, Garth, if you make this one a good price, I'm going to really look after you. I'm guessing you can't have those conversations with Mr. AI or Mrs. AI.
Well, no, you can't. But the great thing is that even though the screen, you're looking at your own castle, through the press of a button, you can be looking at your opponent's castle.
Okay.
So you've got a pretty clear indication of the strategy that they're going for. You've also got a pretty clear indication from the way that they're choosing to price the market to what rooms they're going for.
Yes.
So, yeah, again, it takes a bit of extra knowledge of the game to make it as beneficial as possible, but the physicality of doing it is just sliding it left and right, and it prices everything accordingly, which is really, really easy. Yeah. So look, overall, I really think this is a great addition to the iOS and electronic gaming. I think it is another, it was 2015, so last year it won the Mensa Award. So if you want to play a game that smart people play, then this is a great one. I really love this game. In my heart of hearts, if we were playing tonight, I would still rather play Suburbia. But that's because I'm a nerd who likes hexagon equalness. But apart from that, I love this game.
Fantastic. Well, we'll come back and Trent's going to talk about awkward conversations.
Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. Mark, Trent and Garth here. And just before we head off into the Wild Blue Yonder for another week, I wanted to just reflect on a conversation I had during the week about board games with a colleague at my workplace, which is a relatively new workplace. I haven't been there for, only been there for that, maybe 3-4 months. It's a large place. It's full of engineers and it's very male-centric. All right.
Did your colleague tell you that that track was Little Birdie with It's a Rule?
He didn't. He didn't mention that.
He should
that.
Have.
I'm glad that you've mentioned that, though. Thank you. So we got a new manager in my work, and we got talking, and it was like, what are you doing this weekend? And I'm sort of saying, oh, well, I'm a bit of a nerd. And he's like, oh, really? And we got talking about running RPGs, and it turns out that he was running a session of D&D, and it's like, oh, the little light dawning in each other's eyes as we realise we've hit the nerd pocket.
Yeah.
Because there are lots of blokes in this workplace, and there's lots of, I mean, engineers are nerds, mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah.
So, you know, I've encountered a couple of other gamers, and it's like, oh, yeah, well, I can see you across the cubicle, and but as this guy was talking to me, and it turned out that he'd actually run a game shop previously and sold it for a profit.
Yeah, so, geez, smart guy.
I'm going to try and find out a bit more about that. But as he was talking to me, he was sort of looking around in the office to see who else could hear us talking. So clearly, gaming and pretending to be a wizard is not an acceptable topic of adult conversation. Is that correct, gents? Is it something that you would freely discuss at top volume in the workplace?
Maybe not amongst open company, mixed company.
Why not? Why, I ask you?
Why aren't you proud to be a board gamer, Mark?
Look, I'm proud of being a board gamer. And in fact, because I often wear my Dice Men Cometh hoodie.
That's true.
In my workplace, I do get
people
say going,
WTF.
Exactly. They say those three letters all the time because they're young people. And I say, oh, I'm on a board game radio show. And they're like, what?
Like Monopoly.
Because there's so much ignorance and assumptions, so many assumptions about our hobby. But let's also, let's accept that that's there. Let's mm-hmm. also think about the sorts of people that the hobby actually attracts. And I was thinking about this when I was watching a Kickstarter video this week about the game Yokohama.
Oh, yeah.
On Kickstarter, the new deluxe
Hiyashi,
edition.
Yeah, Hiyashi.
There's, it's showing players from the recent Origins Fair, and it's quite the mix of people.
Oh.
Some of whom I'm like, why did you put this person on your Kickstarter page? Because that is not a good advert for your game. So the perception is clearly that socially awkward people like playing board games because it gives them, I guess, a means to interact with other humans.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a structured engagement opportunity.
So you don't have
it?
To think of a conversation. Yeah, yeah. Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think that is, if we're talking about that particular segment, then yeah, I think that is an absolutely true part of our hobby, is that we get to all sit down at a table having a shared topic of conversation. That's so right. Yeah. You don't have to say, how are you?
Yeah.
Over and over again.
What do you do for a job? Yeah. And look, I get this, all right? Because I was very socially awkward when I was younger.
You were?
All right. I was. to the point where, in order to meet girls, I went and did amateur theatre.
Ooh.
All right? And hey, it worked.
Right? And he still wears the tights to this day.
And I'll just leave it at that. But what I want to make the point about is that, look, if you are feeling a little bit awkward about having these conversations, and I think most of us who are deep into the hobby might occasionally find that, just realise that normal mainstream people are too busy watching A Current Affair, playing golf, and renovating their bloody homes to play board games. And if they are going to play board games, it's going to be Monopoly or it's going to be Pie Face. And I don't care what normal mainstream people think, because I'm a freak. I always have been. I like being a freak. And that's more interesting than playing golf.
This has been an edit of The Dice Men Cometh from Edge Radio 99.3 FM, Hobart's independent youth station. Find us on Facebook and edgeradio.org.au.